So I'll start off with a bit of a confession, and I hope that this does not make you think less of me, or like you start throwing labels around like nerd or geek, okay? I really enjoy like watching illusionists, magicians. Do I have anybody in the room who would be willing to admit that that's something you like to watch? Okay, there's four of us. It's okay. It's great. It's great. I think it all originated back whenever I was a kid in David Copperfield. You guys remember David Copperfield? Was married to Claudia Schiffer, I think, at the time. I don't think they are anymore, but I remember like his specials on TV were fascinating to just watch. They were like appointment viewing, you know, kind of thing for me as a kid. I was going to say I watched, you know, him make the Statue of Liberty disappear, but then I realized I was only four whenever that took place, and so I don't think I watched that. That happened in 1983. 1983 is whenever he made the Statue of Liberty disappear, but he had all these incredible things, and it's just always been fun to me to just watch these illusionists, you know, whether it's with card tricks or, you know, sawing people in half or making things disappear. It's just always, always been a lot of fun, and so when a few years ago this show came out, it was called Penn and Teller Fool Us. Anybody know what I'm talking about here? So Penn and Teller, like comedian magicians, and they've been doing stuff for 40, 50 years. They've got their own theater in Vegas. And so what they did on the show is they would start to invite like these unknown magicians. They would say, hey, come in and show us your very, very best trick. We're going to sit over here. And then at the end of it, we're going to tell you how we think you did it. And if we get it right, then, you know, you got to be on our show for an evening. But if we get it wrong, and if you fool us, then you get to come be a part of our act here in Vegas for a period of time. Really, really cool thing. And so it's always awesome to just see these two guys, these legends of magic, of illusions, you know, just sitting there, and these other unknown magicians coming in and just doing everything they can to deceive these people who are doing everything they can to not be deceived, you know, to just let it just kind of watch it all play out. So it's always fascinated me. So whenever this TV show that came out years and years ago called The Masked Magician, which was a show with a magician who was, wait for it, wearing a mask, okay? And in this show, he would like pull the veil back and he would say, here's how all these tricks are done. And he got in a lot of trouble in the magic community, like people threatening his life and stuff, because I guess they take that stuff seriously. But he revealed all these things. Here's how the illusion really worked. And so I thought with just my interest in illusions that I would spend all week learning how to do an illusion for you. Do you guys want to see it?
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't do that. But, you know, there's this idea out here, this idea of an illusion. And what it really, really is, if you get down to it, the most basic definition is this. It is the condition of being deceived by a false perception or belief. It is a deception of perception to where we perceive something to be real that really isn't. Now, if you've been with us the last few weeks, or if you haven't been, we've been working through this series called Healer, and we've been looking at miracles of Jesus. And here in just a second, we're going to talk about the greatest miracle of Jesus, which is the resurrection, Easter Sunday, which is why we're here. All of his miracles, they were real. They weren't illusions. They weren't, you know, deceptions or anything like that. He was really, really doing these things. But before we talk about the greatest miracle, I want to spend some time talking to you about the greatest illusion that we all fall for. And every single one of us in this room, if you're breathing and you have a pulse, you have fallen for this illusion. And it's this, it's the illusion of control. The greatest illusion that every single person has fallen for is this idea that we can actually control things, that we can actually, you know, dictate outcomes, that we can actually control our circumstances and make things go the way that we want them to be. In fact, there was a UCLA researcher, this is how she defined the illusion of control. It's this, it is the cognitive bias that leads us to believe that we have control over outcomes when in reality, we don't. We don't have control over outcomes. We have control over how we respond to things. We have control over the inputs that we have, but we don't have control over the outcomes. And so what do we do as people? We tend to overestimate the degree of control that we have over uncontrollable events. And we try to control, we control, we try to control. And what do we do whenever we realize that we have no control? we try to control more, right? It's like we get more afraid, so what do? We try to control it a little bit more. We feel out of control. Well, I feel like I'm losing control, so what am I gonna do? I'm gonna control more. And that makes us more afraid because we realize how little control we actually have. And the more we're afraid, the more we try to control. And it's just this sick cycle that just keeps going and going and going and going. It's why it is the greatest illusion. The illusion of control, thinking that we actually have control over the outcome whenever reality we don't. And so today, before we get to the empty tomb, I want to take us to a place to where we see not control, but we see surrender. Let's go to a garden. Let's go to the Garden of Gethsemane. If you've got a Bible, we'll be in Matthew chapter 26 here in just a second. And it's after the Last Supper, whenever Jesus and his disciples have, you know, they've spent their time together in that evening. They've enjoyed that last meal. And so Jesus and his disciples, they go to this garden, the Garden of Gethsemane. And Jesus says, let's go pray, because he knows that the hour is near, that the time has come to whenever he is going to be betrayed, whenever he is going to be handed over, whenever he is going to be crucified. And so they go to this olive grove on the Mount of Olives. And this, on the path there, there's this little thing called the Kidron Valley, which is in between Gethsemane and Jerusalem. And so they walk this path. And this is fascinating to me. On this path, there is a first century memorial to a guy by the name of Absalom. Now, if you don't know the Bible story, that's fine. I'll catch up real quick. So David, of David and Goliath, David, he had a son named Absalom. And Absalom tried to usurp the throne. He tried to overthrow David, to take control of the kingdom, and he betrayed his father. And it was 1,000 years before this evening that Absalom did that. And so this path that Jesus is walking on, there's a memorial to Absalom there, but it's also the path that David took whenever he was running from his son. And David, whenever he got halfway up this hill, he turned and he looked back at the city and he wept. David was betrayed by his son. Jesus is to be betrayed by his own people. And where David wept, Jesus knelt and Jesus prayed. And he says to his disciples, my soul is crushed with grief to the point of death. Stay here and keep watch with me. And then he went a little bit further, bowed to the ground, and he prayed, my Father, if it is possible, let this cup of suffering be taken away from me. Yet I want your will to be done, not mine. And then he returned to the disciples, and he found them asleep. And he said to Peter, couldn't you even watch with me for an hour? He tells him, he's like, look, my soul is crushed. Mark says that he was distressed, he was dismayed, that he was grieving. In other words, he felt like he could die right here in this moment. Luke tells us that at this point, Jesus is sweating drops of blood, which probably indicates a condition, which means that his capillaries have burst in his skin. And so the blood is starting to mix in with the sweat as he is just pouring out of him. In other words, I think we can say Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they all are painting this picture. It's this: Jesus was in trouble. It was real trouble. He was overwhelmed. And what I find interesting is in this time of trouble, even Jesus found that he couldn't control something. And you know what he couldn't control? His disciples. Isn't that funny? I mean, the guy that could walk on water, calm the storm, raise the dead, you know, heal the sick, cast out demons, all those things, he could control all those things, but he could not control his own disciples. He couldn't even keep them awake for an hour. And he just sits there and he prays and he prays and he prays. And so Jesus knows the only thing that he can do in this hour is this, is he can surrender control. There are two big words in that prayer. And if you're underlining, highlighting, or circling things, it's two words, five letters. It's just if and yet. In fact, let's say that together. If and yet. You guys ready? If and yet. If and yet. So what does he pray? He prays, God, if it is possible. If it is possible, God, please let this suffering pass. In other words, if it's possible, can we bypass the cross? Can we bypass the pain? Can we bypass the betrayal? Can we bypass the suffering, the physical, the emotional, the spiritual suffering? Can we bypass me being separated from you? Can we bypass all of these things? Can you please find another way? And I know that it is tempting for us to read this story and just read these as words on a page and to just look at this and think of it like a fairy tale or a coloring sheet. But I want you to understand, this is real temptation for Jesus. This is real. I mean, whenever Jesus began his ministry, it says that the Spirit took him away to the wilderness so that he could be tempted by the devil for 40 days and 40 nights. And so Jesus begins his ministry in the wilderness being tempted by Satan. And now here we are at the end of his ministry, and he is being tempted by the devil one more time, but not in the wilderness, but now in the garden. And the temptation is real. This is Satan's last ditch effort to convince Jesus, hey, you don't have to go to the cross. It's not necessary. So God, if it is all possible, can you please come up with another way to do this? Yet, I want your will to be done, not mine. Yet, nevertheless, but not what I want, but what do you want me to do, God? And notice, Jesus doesn't pray this once. He doesn't pray this twice. He prays this three separate times. Verse 42, it says, then Jesus left them a second time and prayed, my Father, if this cup cannot be taken away unless I drink it, your will be done. Verse 44, so he went away to pray a third time, saying the same things again. And so three times, God, if it's at all possible, if you can make this pass, if there's another way to do this, God, would you please figure it out? Okay, because the clock is ticking here. But yet not my will, but your will be done. And here's what this reveals to us. Here's what Jesus helps us to see. It's this: we can't always control, but we can always surrender. You may not have control over your circumstances. You may not have control over the outcome. You may not have control over the things around you, but you can always surrender. You can always say, yet. So one of the big questions in life that we have to answer is, where is God when life doesn't go the way I want it to? I'm sure everybody in this room, at some point in your life, you have asked this question. God, where are you? Where were you whenever I got the diagnosis? Where were you whenever I was served with the papers? Where were you whenever my kid turned prodigal? Where were you whenever everything seemed to be falling apart? Where were you when the bank account was empty? God, where were you whenever life wasn't going the way I want it to? We all have to answer this question. We all have to learn to come up with an answer to this question that is true, that is honest, and that points us to who God really is. And one of the issues that is at hand is kind of what we tend to believe. There's a guy back in 2005, his name is Christian Smith, and he and his fellow researchers with the National Study of Youth and Religion at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, go Tar Heels, right? He examined the religious beliefs of the younger generations, people who were teenagers in 2005, which means that they are now, in their 30s. Okay, so we're all old, and we're all getting older. Okay, but through their research, what he was able to find is that the faith held and described by most young people at that time came down to something that researchers identified as moralistic therapeutic deism. Okay, so, we'll call it MTD, just for short here, okay? But moralistic therapeutic deism, and the idea is this, is that it's moralistic, meaning that religion is just about being good, being moral, and being nice people, okay? That's the only point of being a part of a religion. It's just like, we want to be good, moral people. Therapeutic, meaning that faith is a way that my life gets better. Okay, that's what it does. In other words, religion should just make me better at life. And then deism is this idea that God is real, but he's not involved unless I really, really need him. So you boil it all down, and MTD is just basically saying this. It's a belief that says a mostly uninvolved God exists to make our lives better. Now, Christian Smith said that's what a lot of teenagers back in 2005 believed. I would say, I think that's just what a lot of people believe here and now in our culture today, that God is mostly uninvolved, and his job is just to make sure that our life is better. And so what that means is we've got a lot of people who are going through life believing some form of this statement, that are thinking things like, you know what, well, because I go to church, because I read my Bible, you know, because I gave, because I served, because I did something nice over here, it's like, because I did those things, my faith in God should make me happy, I should be healthy, I should be comfortable, and I should live a trouble-free life. Sounds good, doesn't it? There's a problem there, though, and you guys are smart people, and I know you're smart people because you're at Corinth Christian Church today, okay? And smart people come here. And so what do the smart people understand whenever you hear a statement like that is? Like, well, if God wants me to be happy and I'm not, then either he failed or I did. Either he's not all good or I just royally jacked things up. It's either his fault or mine. Because if God wants my life to be easy and free of trouble, and suddenly I've got obstacles and trials and difficulties, and then either God's not really good, he's not really involved, that God let me down, or I messed it all up. And that's why there are so many people, and maybe you're in the room today and you've said this before. This is why people say things like this. Well, I tried religion, I tried God, I tried faith, I tried going to church, I tried faith, but it didn't work. I tried it all. I tried doing these things, but it just didn't work. What are they saying? It's like, I tried to be spiritual, but yet life still was hard. And it's like a shock to the system. Because what do we want to believe? Is that God is there to make me happy and my life trouble-free. But here's the deal. The reality of faith is this, is you can't control outcomes, but you can always control surrender. That is the one thing that is under your control, is your desire and your willingness to surrender to him. Because the call of God, listen, if you've never heard this before, I want you to hear this. The call of God isn't to an easy life. And if you surrender to him, it does not guarantee that you're going to get everything that you want. I wish I could get up here and just tell you, yeah, man, you become a Christian, you get baptized, and your migraines are going to go away. You just start coming to church every week, you're going to meet the person of your dreams, and you're going to have this like fairy tale, happy ever after marriage. I wish I could tell you that just becoming a Christian is going to give you every single desire and every single wish that you have ever had in your life. But the reality is that you can follow Jesus. You can pray for his will in your life. And you can still experience difficulty. That's the truth. Because following God's will is rarely easy. But it's always good. Following his will is rarely easy. But it's always good. And it may not feel good in the moment, but I promise you, it is always good. It is rarely easy. And I'll tell you this, it definitely wasn't easy for Jesus. It was not even close to easy for Jesus. I mean, think about it. Jesus never wronged anyone. He was perfect. He was without sin. He was holy. He was perfect in every way, but he was betrayed by one of his own best friends. He was handed over. He was beaten without mercy. Whenever I say he was beaten without mercy, I mean, they pounded him in the face repeatedly over and over and over again until his face didn't even look like a human being's. And then they tied him up and they flogged him on his back with this whip that was made with glass and rocks and leather, and it just ripped, and they ripped off his flesh to the point to where like his organs would have been exposed to the air. I mean, it's to the point where with like he's lost so much blood that he can barely stay conscious, and they like throw this cross on him. They say, walk up that hill. And they tell him to walk up the hill. And then they get him up the hill. And then they drive stakes through his wrists, stakes through his feet. They strip him naked. And they hung this innocent man who did nothing but love people. They hung him on a cross. They spit on him. They cursed him. They mocked him. And here's the deal. He had power to take control. He could have. He could have called a legion of angels. I mean, friends, if that was me, I would have. It's like, hey, can we get some explosive diarrhea and some vomit in this room? Can we do something here? You see what they're doing to me. But he chose surrender. And what did he do? while the creation is mocking the Creator. He looks up into heaven and he prays, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. And then he looks up into heaven and he says, it is finished. I have come to do what I have been sent to do. And then in the ultimate act of surrender, he says, into your hands I commit my spirit. And the world went dark. The earth shook. The temple veil ripped. The disciples scattered. God's will is rarely easy. But 3 days later, God showed that it's always good. Because 3 days later, I mean, think about this, y'all, his heart started beating. His lungs started filling with air again. The blood that had been poured out started to flow through his body again. His body was restored. His nakedness was clothed. The separation from God was restored. The stone was rolled away. He rose from the dead to never die again. To the point whenever 3 days later, whenever these women, they go to check on the tomb and they go and they look inside the tomb, they see that the body of Jesus is not there. It's no longer there because our God raised Jesus Christ from the dead. He defeated death. He defeated hell. He defeated the power of the grave. His work was completed. Death had no power over him. And the people that had been separated from him were now restored. Salvation for us. But before salvation for us, do not miss it. The healer was broken. And it's there we find forgiveness. By his wounds, we are healed. Through his surrender, we found salvation. It wasn't easy. But our God is always good. And why did God do this? So that anyone, and anyone, whenever I say anyone, I mean like anyone, anyone who would call on his name would be saved, that anyone would call on the name that it's above every other name, call on the name that one day every knee will bow, every tongue will confess that he is Lord, the name that is above all other names. If you will do that, confess him as Lord, what will our God do? He will forgive you of your sins. He will heal you of your brokenness. He will remove your shame. He will make you brand new, not just a better version of the old you, a brand new you, the old being gone, because of the amazing grace of the goodness of God. Our God did something for you, something that you could never do for yourself, because you can't be good enough. You can't be righteous enough. You can't do any of those things. And that's why God sent Jesus, who was without sin, who became sin for us. That on the cross, he who knew no sin became sin for us. And he shed his innocent blood so that we could be forgiven. Was it easy? No. Was it good? Oh, you betcha it was good. And how did it happen? Because Jesus chose surrender over control. Where did it begin? Between the if and the yet. Because that's where true faith begins. True faith begins between the if and the yet. So my friends who are watching online, my friends who are in the room, I want to tell you this. We are people who want to have an if-yet faith, not an if-then faith. We are people who are willing to pray what Jesus prayed. God, if it is at all possible, would you please do this? Would you please restore my marriage? Would you please, you know, help us to conceive the child? Would you please heal me of this disease? Would you please get me a new job? Would you please do these things? If it is at all possible, would you do these things for me? But we're not going to say, then I will follow you. We're going to say, but yet, not your will, or not my will, your will be done. Not what I want. What do you want, God? Because faith lives between the if and the yet. We don't have if-then faith. We have if-yet faith, the same faith that Jesus had. If it's possible, but yet not my will, but your will be done. So here's my challenge to you. Would you learn to pray yet this week? Learn to pray yet. Because the question is what are you trying to control that you need to surrender today? I mean, it may be your kids. It may be your health, it may be your finances, it may be your relationships, it may be your future. What do you need to surrender today? Because here's reality. There is no such thing as partially surrendered. You cannot raise your hand and say, I am 85.6% surrendered today. Surrender is an all or nothing gig. You're either surrendered or you're not. And it's a choice that we have to make every single day. And we don't get to say things like, God, I will trust you with some things, but I'm not going to trust you with this over here. You don't get to say, God, I'm going to trust you to save me, but I'm not going to trust you with my kids. I got to control them. You can't say, I'm going to trust you to get me to heaven, but I'm not going to trust you with my job. I'm not going to trust you with my health, because real faith, true faith, begins between the if and the yet. That's where it begins. To where we say, God, if it is all possible, would you please do this, but yet not my will, but your will be done. This is personal to me. In the last couple of years, there's been some things I've been praying about more than I've ever prayed about anything in my life. And I had a moment to where it was in an environment kind of like this, and there was a song going on, and just thinking through, meditating through, trying to be present. And all of a sudden there was this, I'm not trying to be weird, okay? But there was like this overwhelming just sense that God was trying to communicate something to me. And what he was saying to me was, he's like, hey, I know what you've been praying about. Are you gonna serve me even if I don't answer that prayer? Are you going to keep going? And in that moment, I felt a little like Peter, one of the times he got it right. Whenever Jesus looks at him, because a bunch of disciples have left, and he's like, hey, you all gonna go somewhere else too? And Peter looks at Jesus and says, to whom shall we go? You have the words of life. In other words, I ain't going nowhere. And that was my response. It's like, God, I want this answered, and I believe you're going to answer it. I believe he is answering it. I believe it's going to come to fruition. But even if there's that yet, it's not my will, it's his will. Because real faith begins between that if and the yet. That's where it starts. And you can't control outcomes, but you can definitely control your surrender today. And today, maybe for the very first time, you need to surrender to Jesus. Because here's the reality of it. Some of y'all are 20 inches away from the best decision of your life. Say 20 inches. 20 inches, that's about the distance from your knees to the floor. To where you go from standing up tall and proud to where you drop to your knees and you say, all right, I surrender. I can't control. I can't do this. This is not about me. I have tried it on my own, and I have failed it. I have royally messed it up, everything. I've jacked it all up, Lord. You know that. You know all things. And I can't do this on my own. So I'm going to fall to my knees. I'm going to surrender, and I'm going to say, all right, I'm ready for the yet. You've been praying a lot of ifs. Are you ready for the yet today? Are you ready to experience what happens whenever you surrender your control and you experience the forgiveness and the freedom that comes from Jesus Christ? Are you ready to call on his name, to surrender yourself and say, Lord, not my will, but your will be done? If so, here's what's going to happen. I'm going to say a prayer. The band's got another song that we're going to sing through. And if you're ready to surrender, I'll be standing right over here. You just come on up. You come talk to me, and let's talk about what the Lord is doing in your life. And maybe you can experience the yet today. So, Father God, we thank you that you are a God who heals, who saves, who delivers. And today I pray for my friends that are here in the room. I pray for my friends who are watching online, people who need to travel the farthest 20 inches in the history of mankind. And just drop to their knees today and say, I surrender. I surrender to you. Give them the courage to lay down their arms and allow you to take control. In Jesus' name.